please the court, Mr. Schultz, represent argument for the release. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Luke Bowles here with Brad Spankar representing the Relators here. The Relators are computer service vendors to the print media. So that gets you some orientation to the case. This case involves the contact by a defendant, one of the original defendants in the case, with plaintiff's counsel. The defendant was on the same day contact was made, non-suited, and notice of that non-suit was given to the other parties on the same day. 8 months later, the counsel for the defendants took the deposition of Mr. Landreth, one of the plaintiffs, and at least by then knew that the contact had occurred. 7 months after that, this motion for disqualification was filed just 4 months before the scheduled trial date. The motion for disqualification does not even allege prejudice or a conveyance of confidential information. That is not even alleged in the motion. There are two issues that I think will be at the heart of this court's decision. One is the formal existence of the attorney of record status in the trial court record, in the district clerk's record, conclusive on the issue of representational status. If that is the case, then my term for that is the client hostage rule, or the hostage client rule. Because until the former lawyer acts, the client is hostage. The second is, the issue is whether disqualification is, in the circumstances of this case, a suitable remedy for what may have occurred, or what did occur.
Would not it have been better practice for your client at some point to talk to at least the next convenient opportunity to make it known to the opposing counsel that he's no longer representing everybody he seemed to be representing?
Well, if Your Honor, as far as the focus of this case is concerned, if the representational status of record was all that counted, it wouldn't matter. Second,
but you don't think that, so
I do not. All right. And second, if it had occurred after the contact, it probably wouldn't matter either, because if that's the governing issue, then we have a problem. But I think we do not.
Is Frazier,
I think there are reasons. Pardon?
Is Frazier a lawyer?
Frazier is not a lawyer. He is a businessman.
It seems to me that Frazier didn't just sit down and type up this statement himself. It seems to me that he may have had some guidance in typing this up. Is there any evidence concerning that in the
record? There is none. And there was ample opportunity. You see, that deposition that was taken in January, some 7 months later, Mr. Canan went into the nature of the contact and how it happened, and never developed that evidence one way or another. It wasn't developed.
So there's no evidence in the record that there was some guidance from, is it pronounced?
Gouldy? Correct.
Guidance from Gouldy or anybody with Aikenkamp or anything like that with regard to preparing the statement or any understanding that had to be achieved before Frazier met with
him? Well, that is, in terms of preparing the document, that is correct. The latter part of your question, I think, has to be answered more detail. Landreth and Frazier were in contact about settling the differences between the two of them in the case without any orchestration by the lawyers and without knowledge of the lawyers. Landreth and Frazier decided to meet also without orchestration. Landreth arranged to have that meeting in his lawyer's offices. He did. He called, and Gouldy cautioned him that she could not meet with Frazier
because if he had a lawyer. Landreth said that he didn't think Ruck Frazier had a lawyer. But whatever the status of that might be, the law offices were arranged to be, at Landreth's request, to be the status of the meeting. So they came. Gooley was invited into the meeting and said that she could not speak to Frazier if he was represented. And Frazier presented her with the letter that said he is no longer represented. At which point she had secured evidence from him that he was no longer represented. And they had a brief meeting. And the substance of that meeting is what is in the record as a two-page handwritten statement by Frazier. That discloses no confidential information, doesn't touch Frazier's previous representation by Canaan, top side or bottom. It only talks about a document which the plaintiffs had in their possession at the time the suit was filed and was attached to the plaintiff's original suit, and explains how that was the plan, in effect, to do the vendor in by this American. That was the background, and that's about all that happened in the lawyer's offices on that day. So it was just a short, and you, of course, will read or have maybe have already read Frazier's statement, factual statement about the facts of the case.
If the attorney stays in the case, if Goldie stays in the case, and the case is tried and Frazier testifies as an expert, is she not subject to being called as a witness to impeach his testimony?
Well, I think not. There is the lawyer-witness rule. She's not been designated. That wouldn't disqualify even come anybody under our rules if she were disqualified because she would be a material witness. She would not need to be a material witness, however, because her testimony would only be testimony that would corroborate whatever Landreth and Frazier testified to anyway. But she has no knowledge other than the same thing they don't know about that happened.
But they'd be entitled to test her knowledge on what occurred at that meeting. Well, conceivably, she could be on the stand impeaching.
Well, if she were designated as a witness and the trial court determined that her testimony was material, she might not be able to continue, but the firm would be able to continue, and the other lawyers would be able to continue under the present Texas disciplinary rules. That was a change whenever the new rules came out.
A lawyer, should discourage his or her own client from contacting another representative party on his own?
No, that is not correct.
He can do that. The party can do it if he wants to.
Absolutely.
The lawyer just stays out of it.
Says the lawyer is not to encourage that, but there is no...
Don't have to discourage.
That's correct.
But a lawyer must decline to communicate with a represented party, even if the party initiates, as this lawyer did in this case.
Rule 4.02 has more provisions than just that, Your Honor. Rule 4.02 says that a lawyer may not communicate with a party that the lawyer knows to be represented. And knows is defined in the terminology early in the rules before you get to the numbered rules. It's a little hard to find because it's not in the index either, but in the terminology section is actual knowledge of the fact in question. So the lawyer before the lawyer is required not to communicate, the lawyer must actually know at that time that the party is represented. And all of the evidence, and certainly obvious to me, the best evidence that the lawyer could have is the party saying, I don't have a lawyer. I've terminated my lawyer. I am no longer represented. Unless we're going to go to the attorney of record rule, the hostage client rule.
Let me ask you about prejudice. What prejudice would there ever be that resulted from this kind of encounter?
Well, I think there is possible prejudice if the lawyer actually contacted the representative party, knowing that the party was represented?
No, under these circumstances, no, I'm sorry, go ahead with your
As happened in Shelton versus right. Heskett's. And the representative party made disclosures to the lawyer about the trial strategies or that sort of thing that's going on in the defense camp. Perhaps that could show prejudice. However, I think even there, disqualification is too extreme.
This is where I'm a little lost, just theoretically. If it becomes clear, if Brazier has written a letter to his counsel and said, you're fired, I'm going to represent myself pro se in this matter henceforth, why couldn't he have walked across the way and talked to Aiken Gunn and told him whatever he wanted to tell him about trial strategy? What's to stop him from doing that?
Well, I think there isn't a rule that does that. However, there are vague provisions in the attorney-client privilege rule that somebody might say would trigger protection.
Assuming he wasn't waiting, trying to waive someone else's privileges.
Right. And in this case, Your Honor, I want to get to you.
They were his own privileges as well.
They were his own privileges. That's correct. And there is no Rule of Evidence 5.12 claim in this case that some other party had a privilege that they could have protected or that they want to protect. That's not in this record. And that is a provision in the rules of evidence that you get to give other parties the right to step forward and make that claim. As I indicated, that is not even a part of the pleadings in this case.
The issue that concerned me, and I don't even know if it's a concern, but it nags at me, the notion that a party may initiate, for whatever, stressed out, doesn't want to be a part of this anymore, just says, I want to get out, and they go and talk to the lawyer representing the other side, and they say, well, I fired my lawyer, I don't want to be part of this, now let's sit down and see if we can't get out. Should there be some recognition of a protection for the client, for the individual, that would keep the opposing attorney, who has the benefit of the knowledge, the expertise, the access to the system, from using that to basically get a settlement or an agreement out of a party who was, in fact, represented by an attorney, but because they were so stressed out, they said they want out of it, whatever it takes, and therefore they give up valuable counsel and advice from their own lawyer, and I guess it's my concern about overreaching, that perhaps there ought to be an obligation attorney to confirm, sort of like, that's why criminal defendants they don't have to talk. They say they want a lawyer, and they say they want a lawyer, and you can't talk them into saying, no, I don't want a lawyer. Should there be some sort of thing in the civil deal that keeps a opposing lawyer from basically talking them, the other side, into firing their lawyer and talking to them?
Well, yes, I think that is prohibited. I think you set up a hypothetical there where the lawyer is talking to a representing client trying to get them to fire their lawyer. That would be prohibited. On the other hand, Texas has a clear rule that a client can fire the lawyer at any time for any reason or for no reason. And when that occurs, the attorney-client relationship is at an end. Now, in further response to Your Honor's question, I think...
Well, let me change the hypothetical. Suppose one of the parties says, I think this guy will give in, and I'll just tell him, if you just fire your lawyer, we can go up and get this worked out. And so the lawyer's not a part of this. Is there something that ought to say the lawyer ought to take some sort of steps to make sure that's not what's going on or something?
Well, I think that we can actually get to the facts of this case in response to that. When the contact with Frazier came, Frazier knew, and Gouldy, that Mark Canaan had said that his client North America had, or News America had, was not guilty, and that the only parties that might have caused any liability or caused any damage were the individual clients that Mark represented. So Frazier is already knowing that his client, that his former lawyer, is taking a position in favor of a co-party. And Gouldy knows that. That's another part of her state of mind in this case. Now, I feel, and I've thought about this a lot, Your Honor, that it's none of my business to be getting into the attorney-client relationship and the former attorney-client relationship between a now proven unrepresented party and their lawyer, especially when that proven unrepresented party is a former employee of a co-party that the lawyer represented. And I may, by making contact with the former lawyer, be creating risk and prejudice to this individual that I have no business being involved with. And I think there should not be a requirement that the lawyer who's being spoken to call the lawyer on the other side and say, Frazier's in my office and he wants to talk to me. To add to that, then, a period of time in which that lawyer on the other side has power and control over that representation by extending it to withdrawal, can create all sorts of mischief that you can see, we can all imagine, can happen to this individual. I think it's not for me to get involved in that situation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark Mann will present argument for the real parties and interest.
Regardless of the merits of your case, how come it's not barred under our River Center doctrine?
Could you tell me what you mean by River Center?
Too late.
Waiting too long between each step. Too much.
The deposition of Mr. Lander ended in July of the year 1996. The motion for sanctions, motion to disqualify, was filed within a month of the completion of the deposition of Mr. Lander.
But didn't you learn about it in January?
I did, Your Honor.
That's the time period. We're talking about the time period. You learned about it in January and didn't file it until July.
I realize I learned about it in January. Frankly, and I say this in the utmost sincerity, I frankly hope that with the testimony would change. That up until the time of the hearing, I was hoping that there was a misunderstanding that, in fact, the non-suit was not timed in the way that the non-suit was timed.
So how can we write that in opinion that you knew it for a seven-month period, hoping that things would change, but golly gee, it didn't. And under those circumstances, when the counsel hopes that things would change, then you can never let it be disqualified.
I not only hope that they would change, Your Honor, that question was asked in each, not particularly to this situation, but in each of the subsequent depositions, the questions were asked as to whether any of the testimony in the prior depositions had been reviewed and needed to be changed, and subsequent to the last deposition, the deposition was in fact signed and filed. So that in terms of the evidentiary basis for moving forward on a motion for sanctions, it certainly was contemplated during that entire seven-month period, that the actual completion of the deposition, the signing and filing of the deposition, and solidifying that that's exactly what the situation was, that became clear at the completion of the deposition, which occurred, I believe, in July 30th of 1996.
Okay, let me clarify a statement you just made. You say that during that time interval between January and July, motions for sanctions were contemplated.
Certainly, it was in my mind. I don't deny that at all. I mean, that clearly bothered me when I heard the testimony in January. It continued to bother me until the time that I filed the motion for sanctions. It bothered me in each of the other sessions when I asked Mr. Lander for it. One session was actually another lawyer for other defendants, who asked Mr. Lynn if there were any changes, if he looked at his other testimony, and in the July 30th deposition session, the completion of his deposition, the question was asked. Subsequently, then, the deposition testimony is completed, completely signed and filed, and move forward on the motion in fairly quick response.
But you also, Clifton, you mentioned that the line of inquiry had to do with the non-suit. Was what was concerning you? That what I understood.
Well, one of the facts that concerned me and surprised me when I heard the testimony, Your Honor, was the timing of the non-suit, and that is, I think that there were problems all along, obviously, and what I discovered happened as I asked the questions in the deposition, that in fact there had been a meeting that had been in Ms. Gulby's office or in the offices of Elvick and Gump. But the decision to take a non-suit occurred after the completion of that meeting. So apparently, Mr. Frazier walked out of that meeting having given a statement to counsel for the plaintiff while still a named defendant. And no non-suit had been it hadn't even been decided on behalf of plaintiffs to non-suit this gentleman. So we take this, quote, formality, and I think it's a heck of a lot more than that, that Mr. Frazier was a named defendant who had counsel of record, who was meeting with counsel for the plaintiff at a time he had counsel of record, that a statement is given about the nature of the lawsuit, okay. And then he leaves, and they talk, well, I guess we'll give him a non-suit.
It is correct, then, that your knowledge about Mr. Frazier meeting with Mr. Landrum and the attorney at Aiken Gump's offices, you knew that in January of 1996.
That is correct. I certainly knew that. And in terms of taking formal steps to challenge that action, I certainly waited until the end of the deposition. I did so, obviously, quite consciously. Until that deposition was completed, I didn't feel I had a record that would warrant the drastic relief that we requested in the motion.
This seems to conflict with your statement to the trial court that if only you had known, if only you had been told what he was about to do, everything would have been, I think in your words, copacetic.
That's the word I use. I will tell you that one of two things would have happened. If on May 12th of 1995, Mr. Frazier, if he had called me or somebody had called me, one of two things would have happened. I would have had a discussion with Mr. Frazier, and after that discussion, I would have filed a motion to withdraw. Or I would have had a discussion with Mr. Frazier, and after that discussion, I would have continued to represent him. But neither of those happened.
Why is the timing of the non-suit important if that's all that would have happened?
There's the suggestion, and frankly, I learned more about the steps leading up to that meeting listening to Mr. Soles than I ever knew before, because a lot of that's not in the record. All we know is that they met. There is the suggestion that this was a settlement conference of some type, that there was a settlement without benefit of counsel. Well, the record suggests it's not a settlement, because Mr. Frazier walked out of that meeting having given a statement, not knowing whether he was going to be non-suited or not. So that after Mr. Frazier left that meeting, it was the option of counsel for the plaintiffs to take a non-suit or to send me a request for admission or anything else that they could have done given the state of the meeting.
My point is that after you knew all of that, your only complaint to the trial court seems to have been that you weren't told ahead of time.
Oh, I wouldn't say that was my only complaint. That may be in the record, but certainly the motion itself speaks
to it. Maybe I don't understand copacetic. I thought copacetic meant like fine.
I think that a conversation with Frazier or with somebody about it, if I can place myself back in front of the hearing, in front of the trial court, my suggestion or my meaning was we wouldn't have been there. Now, I don't know which of those two courses it would have taken. Whether it would have been a motion to withdraw, and he can speak to counsel for the plaintiffs as much as he likes or doesn't like, or would it have been another conversation with Frazier leading to my continued representation. Either one of those courses, if there had nonetheless been a technical violation of 4.02, and there probably would have been, I don't believe anything would have been done by that, frankly.
If your client wants you fired right this second, doesn't want to ever see you again, cut it off. does he have to wait till you get to the courthouse to file the papers?
Vis-a-vis the client and I, he can communicate that to me immediately, and that would cut off the representation. Vis-a-vis his status in the court, his status with other parties, I think the rules are clear. I'm the attorney in charge of that suit until the court allows me to withdraw and orders are entered to that end. With respect to my client and myself, there's no question that the client has the full ability to terminate that relationship at any time. And the problem here, of course, is that termination of employment was communicated not to me, not to the court, but only through the letter of May 12th to counsel for the other side.
I'm having a hard time seeing why you're here. Why do you have standing? Why does your current client have standing to complain about this? If you think that the Aiken Gump attorney violated the disciplinary rules, you can take that up with the State Bar of Texas. Why do you have standing in this lawsuit to demand that she be disqualified?
Number
what I'm Thank you. one,